Hi, I'm Paul Listick, and welcome to Behind the Curtain.
I heard him say, Mexicans are rapists. I heard him say, Mexicans are bad. My abuelito came from Mexico, so his words just make me mad. I heard him say, preserve, protect, and defend. And when he said those words, was that just pretend? For when you swear, preserve, protect, and defend, you make sure the law doesn't twist and bend.
Well, if you are a Trump supporter and you just listen to that song, you're going, I'm sorry, what? Welcome to this week's podcast, Behind the Curtain. We're going to cover a lot of interesting theatrical things for you during this show and an art exhibit coming up, but we're starting with a show called We the People, subtitled, no surprise, The Anti-Trump Musical. And it is currently playing. You don't. It's not going to be around long, so you got to go catch it at Stage 773 till February 10th. And I am joined by the guy who wrote the music and lyrics for the show, which is really exciting because that's really what so much of this show is. It's just song after song, and you got to listen to the messages of each song. Leo Schwartz with A Grand History. Leo, thanks for you were on my Politics Tonight show. Thank you for joining me now on the podcast.
Thrilled to be here, Paul. Thank you for asking me.
And it was really hard to pick which of the cast members to join, so we went for the most attractive. No, I'm kidding. We went. Well, I could say that to you. That makes you feel good, right? Actually, it's so balanced between the cast members that it's and you're also talented. It's sort of like, well, let's just pick a couple of them. And so we did. So Timothy Swain, Elizabeth Renfro are joining me as well, and welcome to you guys.
Thank you for having us.
Leo, I've got to start with you. Of course, the book was written by your colleague in this project, Sean Chandler. But yep. What made you decide to write a show which would be an anti-Trump musical?
Well, it was just a response to the election. I mean, I woke up the morning after the election and was just devastated and felt this is a great opportunity for me to use my art to respond to a political situation. And then we were given so much material over the following months that it was kind of hard not to.
I found it interesting, by the way. This show, I was there on opening night, but as it continues on, do we get little? We're going to get updates, aren't we? Because different things are happening in the world involving the president.
I think we're going to have to. I mean, I think I start marketing the show beginning of February to other theaters. I'm toying around with the idea of a possible remount. It depends how things go.
Elizabeth, so you are also, if I have this right, the resident music director of Chicago Shakespeare Company, right?
Not Chicago Shakespeare, but a Chicago Shakespeare company called Midsummer Flight.
Okay, yeah. God, I'm sorry. I should continue to kind of finish the thought. But, I mean, you've done Twelfth Night, As You Like It, Macbeth. I'm just sort of curious. When you do that sort of classic Shakespeare work, and then you kind of shift to this, I don't know your political leanings, but was this sort of this is just going to be fun, or I need this too?
A little bit of both, I think. I do other things, musical theater and performing Shakespeare in addition to writing the music for Shakespeare, but it was definitely a stark contrast, and when I saw the posting for it on the audition boards, I thought, like, that is such a great idea for somebody to respond in that way. I'd love to be a part of that. So I auditioned, and luckily it worked out.
And Timothy Swain, so you come from, are you a native of Ohio, I assume, right? Or you studied there?
Yes, I was there until about 2 years ago.
And so you come to Chicago in the summer of 2016, and as you indicate kind of in your bio, while the Cubs mania is going on, was that your way of saying you got wrapped up in it, by the way?
Yeah, I lived in Lakeview as my first Chicago apartment while the Cubs were in the playoffs, so it was kind of like diving in head first.
Yeah, good luck stepping outside. And here's the thing. I wasn't sure when I first met Leo and Sean, who wrote the book, whether this would be like, was somebody playing Trump, was somebody playing Hillary. That's really not what this is, Timothy. This is, you guys are the people. We the people. You guys are just people and exhibiting the various reactions of folks. So tell my listeners a little bit about who you all represent as the show goes on through the various numbers.
So when I tell people that I'm in an anti-Trump musical, I think that a lot of people immediately, their minds go to, like, parody, that we're going to be, like, kind of doing caricatures of Trump and the cabinet. And what I love about this show and the book that Sean wrote and the music that Leah wrote is we chose to move the lens instead to our reaction. And we get tons of different perspectives, something like 55 characters overall. And I play a gay college student. I play a hardcore Trump fanatic. So it is, other than just being about, like, the administration and about what's happened in the year since the inauguration and everything, if I were to say what the show is about, it would be our reaction and kind of what we as American people want to do next.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Oh, no, that's...
Okay, and Leo, you know, first of all, you have to understand, I mean, there's a board up on the stage, and you kind of track it for us, because when the show opens, it opens at the 2016 Democratic Convention. And I got to tell you, for folks who are big Hillary supporters or something, have you had any feedback, or do you get the sense that in some ways, how can I put this, but it's almost depressing at the beginning, because we get all the positive Hillary stuff, but we sort of know how the movie ends?
Oh, I mean, people tell me, they'll come up to me after the show and say, boy, that's really good, but it really brought back some bad memories.
Yeah, but it's part of how you had to tell the story, right?
Yeah, well, that's the only way we can tell the story. I mean, how do we get to where we are today, but from there, you know?
And let me, as you moved it through, actually, Leo, let me ask you, as you and Sean worked on this, the book, the music and the lyrics, so talk a little bit about it. Starts at the 2016 Democratic primary, and just kind of give my listeners a sense of what time span it moves through in terms of the moments in time.
Well, we actually start with the Republican convention and then go to we start with a general basic call about how America views its president in a song called City on the Hill. And then we go into the Republican National Convention, then we go to the Democratic Convention, and then we go into election night, which is where everybody is fighting each other. And then we start going through some chronological hits, political, actual historical hits, the Muslim ban out at O'Hare, the inauguration, the world reaction through our UN translators, all sorts of different bits and pieces and highlights of this administration.
And Elizabeth, I'm curious, you know, again, I'm not tapping into people's political persuasions, but I'm curious as an actress, Timothy, the same question for you as an actor. Let me just make you Trump supporters for a moment, okay? And I don't know what you are, but let's say you're Trump supporters. Would you not do a show like this, or would your view, Elizabeth, be, look, I'm an actress, and so it doesn't really matter what I'm saying. And I guess I could say it, the different characters, you're not every character you play, but you know, something this political, something this devastating in the country for a lot of people, would your view have either propelled you or kept you from being in the show, or is it an irrelevant consideration?
I don't know if it's irrelevant. It certainly wouldn't have kept me from auditioning, because as an actor, you audition for everything. It's a math game. But I think now, having read the script and obviously done it, I just think that it touches on so many subjects that, you know, I think Sean, he talks about how it's not an anti-Republican musical. And we actually even have some people in the characters in the show who were Trump supporters, are Trump supporters, that have maybe decided to change their mind. So I just think it has so many perspectives that it's hard to say you wouldn't want to be a part of it. And I think that the most important thing about the show is that it's not about party or who we voted for, that it's about the people. And that sounds kind of cheesy, but also it's really true that, you know, if we keep going back and forth on party, then we're not going to get anywhere. And that's kind of the whole idea of the musical. And I think that's really important.
Yeah. In fact, yeah. In the song Love and Hate, I think that's Timothy, where you play the gay college student. If I have that right. No, actually, no.
That is the Trump supporter song.
That's the Trump supporter song. Sorry. And that's actually what I meant to be asking about. So I took my teenage kids to the show because I wanted them to see it. And one of the comments my son made afterwards, he said, you know, he said, it's just that number. It was Love and Hate. He's that number where, like, you know, the Hillary people, the Trump people, they like wouldn't hear each other. They couldn't hear each other. They couldn't talk. And I thought, yeah, welcome to the real world, kid.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. That's one of my absolute favorite numbers to perform in the show. Not to get too much into my own political leanings, but I love playing characters who are very different from me, and that character I think of all of the characters I play in the show, is the most different from myself, which makes it a lot of fun because I get the challenge of like, okay, how does this person, where does this person get their worldview that is so radically different from mine? What kind of life must they have led up till now to arrive to kind of the conclusions and the beliefs that they have? And that's a lot of fun as an actor.
And, you know, Leo, when the song 538, and, you know, again, you got to know a little bit about politics to understand what that, maybe just very little bit, but obviously referring to the electoral votes and stuff. And I will tell you, that's another number. You listen to it and you take a moment of pause where you just go, yeah, you know, forget about the millions of people that voted. It all boiled down to that.
Mm-hmm.
Is that, as you selected, as you wrote numbers or picked topics for numbers, once again, as a process with you and Sean, I mean, how did you come up with that? How did you sort of say, you know, yeah, we need a song about 538 because that's why we're in this situation?
Well, you know, I mean, part of my experience was there was a huge, on the left, there was a huge hope that the Electoral College would overturn the results of the election and the Electoral College and the electors would change their minds. I was watching people send emails to electors, and electors responding on social media, and it getting really quite tense. And I thought, well, it really does come down to these people, and you know, some can be swayed, and some cannot be swayed, and we have to explore this. And how would we explore it better than somebody from another country who thought that we voted for presidents based on popular vote rather than, you know, electors? Yeah.
Yeah, and Elizabeth, it's a small cast. It's a small space. It's a very intimate space. I love that. Just a pianist, as we heard in the opening number. It's a pianist who accompanies you. As somebody who's worked in, you know, clearly larger productions and a lot of the Shakespeare stuff, do you like the intimacy of this kind of performance?
Elizabeth? I do. I have done very large Shakespeare productions of, you know, 60 characters, but I do really like this very ensemble feeling group, especially in a show like this where we really have to trust each other and rely on each other, and both with our own personal feelings and with just the demanding work that we're doing. And we've become very close as a unit, including our pianist, and it definitely lends itself to the subject matter, which is good because it could have been bad if there was somebody in the group that felt uncomfortable, but there's been none of that at all, and it's just been a great experience.
I found on my way back to my house, the discussion turned to politics, and it was like reliving all of this again. Timothy, I'm curious. I'm sure you've had friends come see the show, and you get into a discussion. Do you find that just even performing in the show, doing the show, friends watching the show, they all want to talk about this again?
Yes, and two things. One, I think that's really important. I think that whether we like it or not, you know, you can turn the TV off and you can get off Twitter. He is still the president. He's still making decisions. We have to talk about it. I don't think that burying our heads in the sand and, you know, you don't want to, you know, overload yourself because then you'll go a little crazy. But I don't think it's necessarily a totally responsible thing to do, particularly as a, you know, white person living in Chicago, to just bury my head in the sand and pretend it's not happening. The other thing I would say is, and I'm going to echo something that one of our castmates, Dwayne Everett, said, the subject matter is somewhat bleak at times, and we definitely do go to the dark place of it being the night of finding out what happened, of the next day, of the inauguration, of the just surreality of it and the sort of refusal to accept that it's actually happening, which is, I understand, a really horrible feeling. We're going to take you there, but we don't leave you there. And the show does not end on a dour note. It ends on a very, very hopeful note.
Indeed, the song We the People, it does give hope. By the way, there's a number. Now, I'm not remembering which number this is, but where you guys are taking notes and you throw the paper out in the audience?
Yeah. The translators.
The translators, yeah. So I actually got two of those papers. I have them right in front of me. And I just thought I would say.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. I like props and things. I collect props. And so I thought it was interesting that one person actually took lots of notes about what was going on, called Things in Russian, all sorts of things. And the other person's notes, nothing but a scribble. So I would like to point out, Leo, that a discrepancy between these two pieces of paper. I thought I'd just note that.
My husband suggested that we put coupons on those bagels.
I thought you did. It's why I grabbed them. Are you kidding? I add them to the prop collection. This is the first presentation of the Flying Elephant Productions, and but it's not the last. This summer, I want to give you a quick moment, Leo, to tell me about what's coming up this summer, assuming that that will be your world as well.
Yeah, no, it's a play by Orrin Squire, who's lives in Brooklyn. He's a great playwright. He's a young black playwright. He's has written a play called Defacing Michael Jackson, which is about the Michael Jackson fan club in Florida back in the 80s. It's a memory play, and it's about race. It's about coming of age. It's about coming of a sexual identity. And I have to tell you that I started reading this play, and that by the sixth page, I was so sold on it because the dialogue is just so incredible and it's so wonderful. We have Alexis J. Ralston, who's going to be conducting it. She's does a lot of work, not conducting it, directing it. She does a lot of work with Congo Square and Black Ensemble Theater, and we're very excited about this run in July.
Yeah, I'll bring you back to talk about that. And, you know, if you take the approach to Hamilton and casting, maybe Elizabeth or Timothy will play the role of Michael Jackson. It's possible. You never know. Hamilton does. Hey, guys, I want to thank you. It was a fun show. It was depressing. I'm not going to lie, a little depressing here and there. It's a lot of emotions going on. But, Timothy, you said it best. It ends on a positive note, whatever your point of view. And it's called We the People, the Anti-Trump Musical. It is at Stage 773. It's playing through February 10th. I understand that's probably a final date, Leo. True?
At this point, it has to be, yeah.
Okay. You can get tickets at stage773.com, stage773.com. And, hey, if the elections were something you weren't happy about, this is a good way to go spend a little over an hour of your time. That's the other thing. It's kind of brisk, a little over an hour, and no intermission, and there you go. You know, you get all this music, and it's full of music and song and different styles of music, and it was just really a fun experience to sit through and challenging as well, and create a discussion. Leo Schwartz, Timothy Swain, Elizabeth Renfro, thank you guys. Have a great run.
Thanks
with the,
so
with
much.
The rest
thank
of the
you.
Show. All right. You be well. See you soon.
Bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
I say, look at where we are. It's our time coming through. I say, good, me and you. I say, roll. I say, ride. I say, hey, there's food inside.
Thanks, movie was fun.
You think he'd realize?
And that is a number you hear early on in the great production going on at Porchlight Music Theater, Stephen Sondheim's Merrily We Roll Along. That's a really great number to start up with. It may not be a number that you know. You do know music from this show, trust me, even if you're not a Sondheim aficionado. But that really is a great number to open this up because it kind of sets up what this is all about, what everybody is about in this show, and we're going to explain that all to you as I introduce you to my guests. Joining me, that song is called That, Frank? Well, joining me is the guy that plays Franklin Shepard. He's well-known in Chicago, done all sorts of shows out at Drury Lane and just everywhere. If I start going through your credentials, we'll never get to the interview. And he's Jeff nominated and everything else. Jim DeSalm has the lead in this show. Jim, welcome to the podcast. I think it's your first time.
Hi, yeah. Thanks for having me, Paul. Appreciate
I'm so happy that you are with me. And playing the role of Gussie Carnegie, we'll put in place who all of you are in just a moment, is the wonderful Chicago-based actor, Keely Vasquez. And Keely, good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you too, Paul.
Actually, I know that you like toured with Barry Manilow for like a decade, right?
I sure did.
Let's just talk about Barry for an hour.
Okay, great. No one ever asked me anything about
yeah.
it.
I'm sure it never comes up. Okay, one question. Is he nice to you? Like when, you know, you're not on stage, is he just nice?
No, he's like he's a dear, dear, dear friend.
Okay. All right. Well, he's joining us on this podcast. No, I'm kidding. And finally, you know, I saw that and I said, I totally have to mention that. And also joining us, and this is back for his, who knows how many times he's been with me, the artistic director of the Porchlight Music Theater, because he does such incredible work. And this time around, he's directing the show, Michael Weber Returns. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Paul. Thanks for having me back.
Michael, let's start with you because you can kind of set the scene. You just kind of got off of a Sondheim season not too long ago. Mm-hmm. You returned to this Sondheim show, which a little bit interesting is a Sondheim piece. So just explain to the listeners, why this? Why now?
Well, this is one of his most intriguing shows because it appeared on Broadway in 1981, and it had an incredibly short initial run. It only ran 16 performances, and mainly because it had a really notorious launch. It just was a production that kind of crashed and burned in front of the public. They didn't get it right the first time out of the gate. And yet, at the same time, the production itself was jam-packed with what are now some of Stephen Sondheim's most beloved songs. There are songs that have been recorded by Sinatra and Rosemary Clooney and Liza Minnelli and just like Barbara Streisand. Everybody has recorded songs from this show, but nobody really has seen the show. And it was a piece that Stephen Sondheim and George Firth, who were the writers of the piece, they went back to. They didn't give up, and they continued to rewrite the show to get it right. The thing is that, you know, when you set an opening night on Broadway, it's going to be, you know, Wednesday, June 12th. Well, Wednesday, June 12th, you got to show critics what you've accomplished. And what they needed was a little bit more time. They ended up taking the time. They rewrote the show, and they very much more got it right. And that's the production that we are presenting now at Porchlight for Chicago audiences to see.
And indeed, what a great setup. It's beautiful. I love the way you said so many people, of course, do covers on Sondheim songs. And my mind went right to the fact that only Barbara Streisand had the guts to call Stephen Sondheim and said, Stephen, I'm going to kind of change some words of some of these songs here. he was okay with it. That was putting it together. Anyway, so Jim, you play Franklin Shepard. You're kind of the lead. And, you know, as you watch this show, I mean, you're a great actor, you're a great singer and everything. I can't decide if I like your character or not. Should I?
That's an amazing question. I think that that's part of the fascinating part about this story is that Frank is somebody who you can simultaneously really loathe at the very beginning, and then you can see kind of the journey that he goes on and not really be clear if he made good decisions, bad decisions. He may have just been somebody who was carried forward by the momentum of his career and never really stopped to consider what the right decision was.
And I'll tell you what, Jim, just kind of finishes up. Give me a little bit about the players in this. Franklin obviously has two writing partners, so kind of set up what it is we're seeing and how the show kind of structures.
Sure, yeah. So we're centering the story around three friends, Frank and his old friend and roommate, Charlie, who is also his writing partner, and Mary Flynn, who is a young woman who they meet early in their lives, and they become very close friends, creative partners in many ways. And so we track this trio as they create music and theater together, and as they journey into movie making, and as they kind of fall apart, as it were.
And what's amazing about it, it's interesting, you said, and we follow them along, but the truth is, and Michael, this is why I think this is so unique, we follow them along, all right, in reverse order. The show opens in the present, which, by the way, kudos to you, because you literally will, and I won't say today's date or anything like that, because the truth is, on the date I was there, you had projections on the screen of that day's news. So I'm guessing that will change throughout the course of the run through March 11th. Is that, just curious, will you be updating various images and things that show up to make it today?
Yeah, it's something that we're certainly looking to be mindful of in terms of the audience understanding that what we're dealing with is a man who, at this point, if we look at the timeline, is probably about 81 years old.
Right.
The show starts. And we really do want to leave the audience with that impact of understanding, well, here is a guy who was a young man in the late 50s. And that's the trajectory of how the show goes. So you are, what makes it unique in terms of the writing and how a musical goes, usually you hear a big song in a musical, you know, Some Enchanted Evening, and then they bring it back a little bit later in the show as a reprise. What happens is you start with the reprise of the song, and then you later on get to hear how the song really had an impact when it first gets introduced into his life. So the audience is playing a very interesting game in terms of how they're getting to know the characters in a very non-traditional way, but it makes them want to lean in and really start collecting the mystery of the information of this man's life.
And it would be doing the show a disservice to say, and it's told through flashback, because it's just not. I mean, it just moves backwards in time from the present back to, as you say, 1957. And I did. I have to tell you, I walked out and I started doing the math of how old that would make Franklin today. So, Keeley, you played Gussie Carnegie. Tell my listeners who that character is, how she fits into the plot.
Gussie is Guffey is a Broadway star who she and her husband employ or kind of decide that they want Frank and Charlie, who's Franklin's writing partner, to write a show for her so that she can have a hit. That's the basic part of it. But the bigger part of it is that she has a very long relationship. Spoiler alert, not, because the first scene kind of tells you where we're at. She ends up marrying Franklin, and they have quite an arc. You know, they have, aside from Charlie and Mary, they have the longest relationship in the play. And it's a relationship based on, you know, a lot of, obviously the way that most relationships are, but it starts with, you know, her being completely enamored by his talent and ends up becoming a love relationship.
And it is so fascinating to sort of see at the beginning of the show where everybody's ending up, and then you don't start at the beginning and work your way up. You work your way back to see them so young in their career. And so, as you just said, Keeley, there's that relationship. This show has lots of very powerful relationships, men and women, men and men. I mean, even the relationship certainly between Franklin and Charlie and Mary, really intricate. And then there is the relationship Franklin has with Beth. And that, which, by the way, I've heard the song. I'm going to play a little bit of the song, because this is the song that all listeners, I think, who hear this I know that song. I didn't know it was from Merrily We Roll Along. Michael, that's your point, right? We didn't know where it was from. So perfect for the show. So incredibly powerful when you realize what the song is really about within the scope of the show. Let's take a listen, a little bit of a moment to listen to it, because I think listeners who don't know Merrily We Roll Along are about to identify with a song they know very well.
Not a blessed day. But you're still somehow part of my life, and you won't go away, so there's hell to pay, and until I pay, I'll die day after day after day after day after day after day after day.
And that number done by the wonderful Aja Wiltshire, she's who plays Beth. What a great number! What a lucky woman she is to get to sing that song. But Michael, that's the point. The songs that we know outside of Sondheim shows are so powerful within just the realm of the American songbook.
Right, he's one of those writers who really just knows how to capture a very human moment and put it into a song, that the songs become a three-act play unto themselves. But at the same time, they're very easily accessible in some ways, even as pop music, you know, is one of the highlights in the production, is the fact that Frank Sinatra actually sang some of Sondheim's music, and we have worked that into the show to make it, you know, a real occasion
right.
that Charlie, you know, and Frank have written this music and that Frank Sinatra is singing it. So there's a lot of, you know, crossover back and forth from fictional world to real world when it comes to Sondheim in this particular piece.
Jim, you performed, I mean, you've done Sondheim before because you've been in West Side Story, but I mean, you've done Harnack and Bach, you've done Andrew Lloyd Webber, so many different shows in your background. I'm just curious, what's the challenge of doing a Sondheim show for you?
Well, I think that the joy of doing Sondheim is that it's so dense. I mean, you can go through this score, and kind of like what Michael was talking about, starting with reprises and then finding new things later on into the show. He's storytelling through his score, not just his lyrics. And he's an amazing lyricist, obviously, and he writes terrific banter songs like Franklin Shepherd Inc., which Matt Krog does such a wonderful job in this show. But that he is able to narrate through his orchestration. There's a song that I get to do solo at the piano where he is literally like taking melodic ideas and then compounding on them in conjunction with the dramatic moment that Frank is in, where he is trying to blend the worlds of Frank of Mary and Charlie and his life with Gussie. So the challenge is being able to like find all of the nuance within that while still performing difficult music, performing music that is you know, going to tax you as a musician, but also as an actor.
And by the way, Michael, Jim, you're actually playing the piano, right?
Yeah, sure am. Yep.
Because you know, there are times the piano's not being played, but you know, usually on stage they kind of turn the piano so the audience can't see it, so that we don't know the actor's not playing. But it's very clear that you are playing. And Michael, looks like you've got a couple of other. I mean, Jonathan Stombers is in the show. He's clearly playing musical. So part of the requirements in the casting here was you need to play some musical instruments for certain characters.
Absolutely. Frederick Harris is also playing on the stage. So, I mean, we are wanting to keep this as authentic as possible. So the people that are working as the, you know, audition accompanist or somebody playing a piano at a party, they're all there and they're all playing Sondheim music, which is very difficult. And then there is a 7-piece band within the show itself, being conducted by Aaron Benham, who's our music director. So you've got music coming from, you know, on stage, off stage, you know, it's a wide variety of how it's interpreted.
It's one of the reasons I love everything Porchlight does and everything you direct, because you fill that theater with voices. You do it here at the Ruth Page Center for the Arts. You did it up on Belmont when the theater was there. The casting is always powerful. It's that voices in the blending. Keely, you were also in the Heights. Let's pretend Michael's not here. So be careful what you say. But I'm so impressed with Michael Weber as a director. Talk to me about your experience of watching the work of Michael Weber as he puts a Porchlight production together.
That's a great question. You know, I've known Michael for a lot of years. And
longer than Barry Manilow?
Much longer.
Ooh, wow, okay.
He and I have collaborated on some things together that weren't, you know, necessarily theater, more concert-wise. And watching him direct Sondheim has been different than watching him direct anything else. And the love and the care that he brings to the, especially this particular piece, it was really, you know, I think Jim can say the same. It was just like the entire process was filled with a lot of care and joy. And I mean, the show is not a happy show per se. So there was also a lot of, you know, it's sad. There are things that about the show that are difficult, but you know, it was just, the whole process was so great. And watching him find how we opened the show, which, you know, again, no one's ever opened this show this way. And watching him, especially work with Jim on those, you know, finding those beats to tell the rest of the story, it was really special. I know that sounds ridiculous to say.
No, it doesn't. And I went to you because I know you've worked with Michael for a long time. And I've actually, as much as I've talked to Michael and other people, I've never actually asked anybody that question. So I wanted to put it on. And I have a personal reason for wanting to know it, because Michael, let's just take 30 seconds to mention something that I'm going to actually get to work with you and be directed for the first time for you. So quickly mention what we're going to, and pay attention to this, Jim, because this is a role you're not getting.
Well, Paul is going to be, and you know, Keeley's directed one of these, Paul. I'm not sure if you knew that.
I did know that. Yeah, she directed New Faces.
MC, the host of one of our New Faces Sing Broadway series coming up next year, which is where we take, you know, a full season on Broadway. And Paul and I have talked about a particular role that he is very fond of, which is Tevye in Fiddler on the Roof. So we pick a particular season. So I said, well, why don't we pick 1964, which was the year that Broadway was, you know, had the premiere of Fiddler on the Roof, and have Paul host the show and give him a crack at being able to sing some of those Tevye songs while he hosts and introduces some of the new young talent in Chicago. But the show is not only it has Fiddler on the Roof. It has A Funny Girl. It has Hello, Dolly was on Broadway that season. Golden Boy, Fade Out, Fade In, 110 in the Shade. It was one of the great, great Broadway seasons. Paul is going to host it for us. New Faces Sing Broadway 1964. And for Paul's listeners who will be able to come, they will be able to see him sing some of the great songs introduced by Zero Mostel and all of the other great actors that followed. So we're excited to have Paul raise his voice.
I am so excited. But by the way, I just purchased, you know, I collect things. I just got a sketch of Tevye done by Zero Mostel.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
So, Jim, that's why I said stay away, because I know you've been in Fiddler on the Roof. You may understudy me, but that is as close as you're going to get.
That's fair. I think Tevye is well off my plate for a while.
Well, I thought we were kind of the same age, but that's me. Jim DeSalm, Keely Vasquez, Michael Weber. The show is one of Sondheim's classics, Merrily We Roll Along. It's at the Ruth Page. I've got to get used to saying that. It's your new location, Ruth Page Center for the Arts at 1016 North Dearborn. Playing through March 11th. You can get tickets at at PorchlightMusicalTheater.org. Theater is spelled the correct British way, T-R-E at the end. PorchlightMusicTheater.org. Don't miss this. I mean, don't ever miss a Porchlight production, but don't miss this great Sondheim show, because it is a real treat. You guys, Keeley and Jim, are fabulous in it. The whole cast is fabulous, as they always are. And we're going to go out playing a little more music from this show that I think people know. Thank you guys for being with me. Have a great run in Merrily We Roll Along.
Thanks, Paul.
Old friend, how do we stay? Old friend, who is to say? Old friend, how will old friendship survive? One day just having a laugh a minute. One day comes and they're a part of your lives. New friends pour through the revolving door. Maybe there's one that's more. If you find one, that'll do. But us old friends, what's to discuss, old friends? Here's to us, who's like us.
And we're going to switch gears a little bit now from the sort of live theater component and take you to something different. We're going to take a visit to an exhibit coming up at the Bridgeport Arts Center. It's an exhibit entitled Honoring Legendary African-American Artists, Distinct Portraits by Disabled Artists. Joining me is the executive director, Nancy Gomez. She's the executive director for Project Onward. What a cool place it is. Nancy, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So you're in Bridgeport. Fill my listeners in. Exactly what is Project Onward? Well, I already said it was in Bridgeport, but tell people what it is you do.
Well, Project Onward is a studio and gallery for adult artists with mental disabilities and disorders like autism or bipolar disease. And we provide all the materials and the workspace for our artists to create art. And when we sell it, they get paid. We are located in Bridgeport, and it's become a very large arts community here recently.
So, yeah, and the reason we're talking about it now is because of this exhibit that's coming up, Honoring Legendary African-American Artists. It opens, there's a VIP gallery event on the 9th of February, and then the public gets to come in starting on the 16th through March 30th. So is this, I mean, does the gallery itself, or does Project Onward go from various exhibits to various exhibits? Is it all sort of leading up to this particular one? How does this fit into the scheme of things?
Well, we are always trying to inspire our artists to make art. And so what we do usually is on a monthly basis, we have what's called a third Friday, which is an open studio night. That's actually in all of Bridgeport. And so we will ask our artists to do something special. And at least once a year or twice a year, we'll try to get a grant in order to do something really special. And that's what we did. The National Endowment for the Arts and the Chicago Community Trust both gave us a grant to do this exhibit. And so it's a ticketed event, and you can go to projectonward.org and purchase a ticket, which is relatively cheap. They're $25 a ticket, or $5 for a senior or a disabled person or a student. Again, we're always trying to make sure that our artists are inspired and creating art, and so that people can come here and purchase it.
And how do you? So is this gallery? Is it sort of open? Well, I keep calling it a gallery. Is it a place that's open to the public at all times, or do you need to be an artist who's in residence there? How does that work?
Oh no, absolutely. It's open to while we're open. We're open with the artists on from Wednesdays through Saturdays from 11 to 5. And you can walk in at any time. We have one gallery where we exhibit the artwork, but the artists are working at their stations all day long. And they love to meet people, they love to show their work, and we get visitors all the time.
How do you find the folks, the artists, the folks that you're going to work with? How do you find them? Do they find you?
They actually find us, and they find us through word of mouth. They find us through their social workers or even their art teachers. And we do also hold a lot of tours by schools, high schools, that have disabled students that are interested in art. So when that happens, they come to us and they'll say, you know, I'm a great artist and I'd love to join your program. So we set up an appointment with them where they come in and show us their work. And if it's a good fit between them and us, we'll hire them.
Wow.
We have about 50 artists ranging from the age of 22 through 65, male and female, from around the Chicagoland area and some suburbs.
I know that this the exhibit coming up, the African-American Art Legends exhibit, is going to feature Harriet Powers, Kerry James Marshall, Elizabeth Catlett. Is there a decision on how is it determined to make either who participates on your end or who's going to be honored? Who's making those decisions?
Well, that was our studio manager. She's an artist, and when we decided to look at the artist, the legendary African American artist, there were a lot, and we decided, using the aesthetic of the type of art that our artist does and the type of art that the legendary artist does. And we tried to join that together. So, in other words, one of our artists, Andrew Hall, his artist that he's portraying is Kehinde Wiley. Kehinde Wiley is alive, and he likes to do portraits. So, which Andrew also loves to do portraits, and very, very good portraits. And they both have worked in stained glass. So we thought that was a really easy fit for Andrew, yeah. And he's done a wonderful job on his portrait.
I just have to imagine, because I think it's so fabulous that you're working with these folks with these disabilities and letting them express their art in this way. I can't imagine the growth you see over time with some of these folks.
Oh, you're absolutely right, because, as you know, the artists, they have to deal with this disability every day, or a mental illness every day. But when they come here, they create art, and if they sell the art, they become more confident with themselves, and they can overcome shyness or depression or whatever it is that's bothering them. And I've seen growth with several artists. We have an artist who came in with his brother, and he was very shy and would stand behind his brother and look down and not talk much. But just recently, in the last 2 months, we had a musical event here, and I asked anybody who wanted to sing or dance or play rap music or do whatever they wanted to do, and he actually came to me at the end and asked if he could dance, and he did, and then he asked if he could sing, and he has a beautiful voice, and it was just astounding the difference that I saw in him, from his being shy to just coming right out and being a performer.
Wow, it's going to be amazing. The proceeds of the benefit that we've been talking about are going to help Project Onward and its artists. I think this time around it includes, if I've got some of the names right, George Zuniga, David Holt, William Douglas, David Hentz, Elizabeth Barron, other folks who are part of the project. And I'm right that Project Onward is doing this particular exhibition in partnership with Adaptive Chicago, We Are Lions, and the Chicago Public Schools as well, right?
That's correct. We're going to go to one of the schools with several artists and show the artwork and talk about the artwork to the students.
Well, the VIP gallery event is February 9th, 6 to 9 p.m., then opens to the public on February 16th through March 30th, and as Nancy said, Tuesday to Sunday, 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. The website where people can either get tickets for the event, learn more about you, is projectonward.org, correct?
That's correct.
You're located at 1200 West 35th Street, the fourth floor. The phone number there is 773-940-2992. Nancy, this is just really incredible work and so important in the community. I'm glad to see you get support, and I believe that your work will continue to grow and prosper there because you're helping a community that I know appreciates it.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
You got it. Nancy Gomez, the Executive Director for Project Onward. Check it out. Projectonward.org. Thanks, Nancy.
Thank you.
Well, if you want to know more about what we've talked about here, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Paul Lisnek. That's P-A-U-L-L-I-S-N-E-K. And I'd love to hear your comments or topic suggestions for future podcasts. You can also go to my website, paullisnek.tv. And hey, don't forget to hit subscribe on WGN Plus and iTunes and tune in each week to hear more insider scoop coming to you from behind the curtain.